Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Is the Jewish religion a sincerely held religion? Or is it, at least in part, a cover for other activities? Is it merely a disguised parasitism? Is it an anesthetic compound like that injected into the entrance wound caused by a mosquito, used to prevent the host population from reacting against the Jewish population and their subversive activities? No man is better qualified to increase our understanding of this subject than the late, great Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver, a classicist, linguist, scholar, and one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. This week we continue our excerpts from his insightful work on the subject, under the title, The Jewish Plague, Part 6. I give you the words of Revelo P. Oliver. The Jewish Religion. While it is scarcely possible that Jews do not know they are practicing deceit and fraud when they cozen goyim, it is likely that they feel much as do members of our race when they shoot deer or ducks from blinds. But we can only make precarious guesses about their own feelings about their religion. What is clear is its usefulness to them in their attacks on other races. 1. The religion is the perfect cover for the Jews' racial arrogance. If they claimed, on any other grounds, to be the master race, and proclaimed that the members of other races were so inferior that they were little, if at all, better than swine, the Jews would arouse resentment from persons who were unwilling to accept that status. But peoples that have emerged from barbarism, even if still deeply imbued with superstitions themselves, have learned to be tolerant of many strange superstitions and strange gods, and know that there is virtually no limit to what votaries can believe. The Jews further disarm resentment by professing to share their status as a master race with any convert, and profess to be eager proselytizers, but have taken the precaution to impose on proselytes sexual mutilations that alone suffice to exclude virile men, and grotesquely barbarous taboos that are certain to repel every goy, except a few females who are so light-headed that they will make useful puppets. Their faith in their innate superiority is thus shrewdly disguised. 2. The religion is a perfect cover for conspiracy. When the Jews invade a country, they normally make themselves inconspicuous by infiltrating a few at a time and planting a few of their number in every city, town, or even village where there is money to be made by exploiting the stupid natives. If the scattered groups of invaders maintained a close liaison with other members of their race, both within and without the nation they are attacking, and claimed to do so on the basis of any common interest except religion, they would soon be identified as an alien and enemy conspiracy. But by claiming that they have a common interest in the worship of some god, they persuade the citizens to think of them as merely the votaries of some absurd but harmlessly foolish cult, and to overlook the real solidarity of the invaders. 3. The religion is the perfect means, and this is most important, the perfect means of making certain that Jews will be persecuted. It must be realized that the Jews' success depends on their cunning in having themselves persecuted. By perpetually whining that they are a poor, helpless, persecuted minority, they effectively disguise their real power and their success in wrapping their tentacles about their victims. And by exciting the pity of soft-hearted and soft-headed goyim, they can use those goyim as weapons against the others. By establishing a reputation for being persecuted for their religion by awfully wicked pagans, they can make it seem that they, poor innocents, are suffering for their piety, whenever their depredations and malevolence have so exasperated their victims that the latter try, by legislation or violence, to free themselves from the aliens who are exploiting and oppressing them. 4. The religion is perfect camouflage, whether or not it was consciously designed for that function. First of all, it enjoins on the race practices so barbarous and taboos so absurd and inconvenient that members of other races cannot believe that any rational beings would voluntarily submit themselves to what the Jews call their law, and therefore assume that the Jews do so only from a slavish fear of their capricious and ferocious deity. That convinces the goyim that the Jews never dare to disobey the supposed will of their God. The Jews have equipped themselves with holy books containing specific regulations, such as the so-called Ten Commandments, which were, of course, designed only to promote solidarity within the race and apply only to members of it, but which can be represented to the stupid Gentiles as governing the Jews' conduct toward them. Thus have the Jews enveloped themselves in a reputation for so fearing their deity that they obey his written instructions punctiliously, even in their relations with other races. So thoroughly have the Jews implanted this notion in our people that many Aryans, even if they have no religious preconceptions, almost automatically exonerate Jews from charges that are supported by evidence that would suffice to convict members of any other race. The testimony of eyewitnesses who entered the inner sanctum of the temple in Jerusalem is rejected out of hand. The pious Jews wouldn't have had such a shrine. Strong circumstantial evidence of ritual murders is simply disregarded. The God-fearing Jews wouldn't indulge in human sacrifice. Every nation on which the Jews have fastened themselves since they first appear in history has been destroyed by internal subversion and corruption. But no one inquires to what extent the alien body lodged within the nation was responsible for its disintegration and final doom. The high-minded Jews would not harm their hosts. And so it goes. Our people have been conditioned automatically to accord to the Jews an exemption from the rules of evidence that we observe among ourselves. So far as I know, no Aryan charged with theft or murder has ever thought of proving his innocence by asserting he is a Christian and producing his Bible as proof that Christians cannot steal or murder. No one has ever claimed that the 30 Years' War must be an invention by pagan historians to slander Christians, since it is unthinkable that two sects of gentle, loving, lamb-like Christians would have so barbarously slaughtered one another. The religion provides a means of penetrating even the inmost circles of nations and societies of credulous goyim. A Jew has only to claim that he rejects the religion and to have himself sprinkled with holy water to make Christians fancy that he has been miraculously transformed and is no longer a Jew. Non-Christians are as gullible, for if a Jew does not observe some of the taboos and is seen to eat pork, and if he affects adherence to their culture, they accept him as one of themselves. The Jewish religion could have been designed to facilitate the planting of Morenos in the heart of invaded nations. 6. Their reputation as being on intimate terms with supernatural beings gives the Jews a great advantage in peddling sorcery and similar hokum in societies marked by a high level of ignorance. In the Middle Ages, for example, and even during the Renaissance and the Reformation, the practice of magic to bilk the credulous and to impose even on the rulers of states and learn their secrets was almost as useful to the Jews as usury and commercial fraud in subverting European society. A quick glance at any grimoire of the time or at the summary in Arthur E. Waite's Book of Ceremonial Magic will suffice to show that both terminology and practices come from Jewish sources, especially the Kabbalah, adapted to impose on the Goyim. 7. Their expertise in superstition has always given the God people, as the Jews like to call themselves, the ability to influence and divert native religions for their own benefit. Since such work is done covertly through Morenos and dupes, we can only suspect Jewish influence in many religious civil wars without being able to prove it. It is, for example, historically certain that when Cyrus the Great undertook the conquest of the Babylonian Empire, the Jews in that nation operated, as they always do, as agents of subversion to weaken and betray their hosts. And that after Cyrus captured Babylon without a prolonged siege and fighting, he repaid the Jews for their good work, which had spared the lives of many of his soldiers, and, as many another conqueror was to do later, rewarded them for their betrayal of his enemies with special privileges. The Jews, according to their traditions, flattered the triumphant Goy by calling him their Christ, and probably rubbed their hands together in glee as they prepared to use those privileges to exploit the natives of various regions in the expanding Persian Empire, eventually including the native Egyptians, as we have learned from the Jewish papyri found at Elephantine. We may reasonably infer that the Jews stealthily opened the gates of Babylon to the Persians so that Cyrus could take the strongly walled city without fighting. But we can only conjecture what contributions they made to the agitation and demoralization of the Babylonians that weakened the empire before the Persians invaded it. The tale of the fall of Babylon in the Jews' storybook is, of course, an impressive fiction, probably composed almost 400 years after the event by an author who did not even know the name of the last king of Babylon, who was Nabonidus, and evidently a great benefactor of the Jews, who naturally knifed the sucker in the back when they had a chance to do so. There may be some truth, however, in the Jews' tradition that their hatred of the Babylonians was given a religious coloring, and the ranting attributed to Isaiah, as well as parts of the tale called Daniel, may preserve a memory of religious agitation carried out by the Jews in Babylon. Now, one major cause of Nabonidus' difficulties was what amounted to a religious civil war in his domains, ostensibly between votaries of the god Sin and the votaries of Marduk, carried out with a ferocious fanaticism that seems strange among peoples long accustomed to polytheism, even though some of them are Semitic by race. And there is evidence that some, we know not whether few or many, of the votaries of Marduk were peddling a kind of monotheism, claiming that he was the only god, or good god, and that other gods were merely aspects of him. The Jews, of course, never hesitate to promote whatever god is useful to them. For example, Sabazius in Rome and Osiris in Egypt during the 2nd century BC. Whatever god is useful to them in manipulating Goyim. And we may suspect that they were meddling with the Babylonian religion, as well as contributing in all probability to the economic depression and inflation in Nabonidus' realm. But so far as I know, we have no proof. The same is true of many later events in history. Although a few obscurities remain, the origin and evolution of Christianity is now well known. But the subject is far too complex for full exposition here. We may note, however, one stage in that evolution, the Protestant Reformation, which was, if considered historically, a terrible calamity that drenched the streets and fields of Europe with much of the best blood of our race, impoverishing it genetically, while the Jews watched gleefully and profited enormously from both sides, and with the fragmentation of Protestantism, all sides. Now, many causes contributed to that disaster. But if we try to identify one single incident that triggered the explosion, we must fix on the cleverness of the Jews in Florence, when in 1485 they bamboozled and exploited Giovanni Pico, Count della Mirandola and titular Prince of Concordia, extracting enormous sums from the too wealthy young man, while filling his vigorous but adolescent mind with Kabbalistic hocus-pocus, telling him it was the true essence of Christianity. From Pico, the clue leads directly to Reuchlin, Pfefferkorn, Luther, who was tactfully guided by his helpful Jewish friends until late in his life, when he perceived how they had used him, Ulrich von Hutten, and the ghastly wars of religion that convulsed Europe for 3 centuries. It would be absurd to claim that the catastrophe was the result of a Jewish plot, but it is legitimate to pose the question, to what extent Jewish intrigues and manipulations contributed to it? That is a problem that could be the Hauptwerk of a diligent and objective historian willing to devote his life to the requisite research. You've been listening to The Jewish Plague, Part 6, written by Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver and presented by your host, Kevin Alfred Strom. To read more of Dr. Oliver's works, visit nationalvanguard.org/Oliver. That's National Vanguard, all one word, .org/Oliver. We'll continue this important discussion of the Jewish question by classicist, scholar, and teacher, Dr. Revelo P. Oliver, next week on American Dissident Voices.